Okay, my name is Mike Matuzzi. I'm the founder of Contemporary Spirituality, connecting wisdom teachers with sincere seekers is our motto, and going all the way back to 2016, 2017, when it occurred to us that in addition to these national speakers that we had been bringing to Kansas City, that there were many local wisdom teachers here in Kansas City, the name Bill Timaeus came up early and often. So we reached out to Bill. We have this very complicated vetting process that typically involves a cup of coffee at some local diner. And Bill and I met at the Big Biscuit off 95th and Knoll, as I recall, and long conversation where I said, Bill, what do you want to talk about? And you said, hey, I got a new book out. That'd be a good place to go. And away we went. So Bill would have been one of our early speakers. I think you had a new book out then that you pretty much addressed. And then I looked at your biography, and let me just give the listeners a quick summary, and Bill, you can fill in the blanks. But 1967, graduated University of Missouri School of Journalism, 27 years with the Kansas City Star, former Faith Section columnist. What else? Lots of books. A Gift of Meaning, co-author of They Were Just People, Stories of Rescue in Poland During the Holocaust, Story of Middle Americans, or Woodstock, A Story of Middle Americans, 2015, co-authored with Reverend Paul Rock, who I think is at your church, Jesus, Pope Francis, and a Protestant Walk into a Bar, Lessons from the Christian Church. Latest book then was A Value of Doubt, Why Unanswered Questions, Not Unanswered, Unquestioned Answers Build Faith. And then I know you have a new book coming out, and I know you want to talk about that. So, all right, Bill, for starters, is more or less correct, or did I miss some things there?
No, more or less correct. I was at the Star. I was on the editorial page for 27 years or thereabouts, but I was at the Star almost 36 and a half or thereabouts full time, and after that on a freelance basis for a while. So I'm even older than you imagine.
And you are a writer, and you did you continue to do some freelance writing for the Faith Section of the Star. You write columns for the Presbyterian Outlook, for the National Catholic Reporter, and a column for Flatland. And then I know you have is it a weekly blog as well?
Well, it was daily for from the time I started it in 2004 until January of this year. But now it's a couple of times a week. It's called Faith Matters, and it's on typepad.com.
Very good. And then I can see you're active on boards, which is probably some of the action component of your journey, but you list Kansas City Hospice, a Hermitage Spiritual Retreat Center, which I don't know about in Pittsburgh, Missouri. That'd be fun to learn more about that. Kansas City Interfaith Youth Alliance and Council of Advocates of the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education. So very good. And then I know you're an elder at the Second Presbyterian Church, which is one of our more enlightened progressive churches from my vantage point. So you are reading and writing and speaking and out and about serving is what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's a busy life, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
All right. Well, tell us more about you. Were you only child, one of 10, grew up here or elsewhere, or how'd you get going in life? And take us there into kind of your faith journey, if you will.
Okay. I was born in Woodstock, Illinois, a small town northwest of Chicago. It's about 20 minutes straight south of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, up in Dairy Country. In fact, my father was a county agent, farm advisor, attached to the University of Illinois Extension Service. And I am one of four. I have two older sisters and one younger. My oldest sister is a Juilliard pipe organ graduate and still works and teaches in the Bay Area in California. My next older sister is a retired RN at Duke Medical Center, and she and her husband live on Cape Cod now. And my youngest sister is a former teacher and administrator with a company that makes audiovisual material for teachers, and she and her husband live in the Chicago area in Libertyville. And we were growing up members of a small Presbyterian church in Woodstock, Illinois. There were, I don't know, 250, 300 members, something like that, in a town of about 7,500 people. Today, actually, Woodstock is three times that size. I was, you know, confirmed on my when I was 13. After returning from 2 years in India, my dad was part of a University of Illinois agriculture team sent to India in the 50s, and it was there that I was met and was introduced to Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and Jains and others. It became the beginning of my interfaith education. But eventually, toward the end of my high school career, I began to look around and I decided in an arrogant teenage way that this church is full of hypocrites and why would I want to be connected with them? So I sort of walked away from the church for about a dozen years until one day I realized, oh, I'm one of those hypocrites. I need some help with this. But in the interim, I had never lost my interest in the eternal questions. I read theology as some people read mysteries. And beyond that, when I worked in Rochester, New York for the afternoon paper in the late 60s, I attended a few lay theology courses at Colgate-Rochester Divinity School. I eventually, when I came to Kansas City in 1970 to work for the Star, I was married by then, and starting in 1972, began having children. I have two daughters. But as the children began to come along, I began to imagine what it is that I would tell them about the eternal questions. And so out of kind of self-education, I began to return to church, and fairly quickly through a friend at the Star found my way to Second Presbyterian Church and almost immediately got slapped into a job of teaching 6th and 7th grade Sunday school.
That's great.
And as you know, you cannot... The best way to fill your knowledge gaps is to teach. I mean, you have to know what you're talking about. So yeah. So that helped.
That's great. And so Kansas City, that was the job with the Star that brought you here. I was wondering, growing up in Woodstock, Illinois, and then you got family all over, how you got here. I think that explains that. And now I'm putting the pieces together in one of your books, Woodstock, the Story of Middle Americans. That's where you grew up. Is that book in 2014, I guess, huh?
Right, yeah. What I do in that book is to try to answer the question of what it was that those of us who came after the so-called greatest generation, what did we bring to this country? How did we adapt to change? How did we create change and accommodation? And how did we live our lives? And so although the book is rooted in stories out of Woodstock, it is really a broader book that tries to get at what my generation brought to the country.
Okay, and is there any way to summarize that in a paragraph or so? What did you conclude?
I concluded that in some ways my generation is all over the lot, but I think we were a people who questioned authority. We were people who still question authority, but in a constructive way. We don't want to just destroy things without a plan for rebuilding. We were among those who were willing to ask what I described earlier as the difficult questions of religion, as I talk about in my Value of Doubt book. We were not willing to just accept rote answers, but we were patriotic Americans. We I had two high school classmates who were killed in Vietnam, but I'm among those who later came to say this was an unjust war, and my friends died for no good reason. So that's a quick summary of sort of the people that the class in which I grew up, so to speak.
Yes. How about this book that I haven't read, I apologize, but I bet it's very interesting that you co-authored with Paul Rock, Jesus, Pope Francis, and a Protestant Walk into a Bar, Lessons for the Christian Church. What was that all about?
When Pope Francis was chosen to be the pontiff, it was interesting that so many Protestants seemed to be immediately drawn to him. And we wanted to explore why that was and what we could learn from him. So Paul Rock, our pastor, who's a brilliant guy, and he's just terrific in the pulpit, but he put together a series of sermons about Pope Francis, and he didn't do all of them. Others on staff do some of them. But what we did then was to kind of redraft those sermons about what we were learning from Pope Francis, put a good introduction to it and some study questions with it, and Westminster John Knox Press, the National Presbyterian Publishing House, put it out, and it's been used by study groups around the country to kind of help Catholic Protestant relations, among other things.
Yes, I think Pope John Paul II on the Catholic side probably did a lot, and Francis has certainly continued that for Catholic Protestant relations. But you and I are old enough to remember, you know, the days when if you were Catholic, you stayed within the box, so to speak, and if you were Protestant, you stayed within the box, and there wasn't much of any dialogue.
Yeah, that's right, and that's so sad. And you go back in history as beginning really with the Great Divorce in 1054, when East and West split into Orthodox and Roman Catholicism, and then in the 1500s when the Reformation came. We as Christians have not set a very good example for loving each other and along well, and it's kind of a sad story, but it's important that we know that history.
Yeah. Speaking of sad stories, I was looking through your blogs, and I see a lot of concentration on topics like this, which are very modern, pressing topics, how white Christianity promotes whiteness. Why knowing U.S. Protestant history is so vital, work in anti-racism and so forth. Talk about that a little bit, if you will. Yet another area that it seems to me we sure need dialogue on, right? Just America's original sin, white supremacy, white supremacy culture.
Yeah, and we are, those of us who are white, have been slow to acknowledge this history and where it comes from and how it informed the entire way the United States was shaped in its early days and even before. And that matters now because, particularly since George Floyd's murder, we are relooking at all of that, at the insistence of not just black people, but white people as well. Black people have rightly been on us for a long time to get this right, and we've been slow to respond to that. It's not that we've made no progress. We certainly have, thanks to people like John Lewis and Martin Luther King and C.T. Vivian and others, Rosa Parks. But the fact is that as Christians, we are called to understand that every human being is a child of God and bears the image of God. And so as a Protestant Christian, and I know this is the case with all Christians, we are required to see and recognize Christ in other people, and that is one of the hardest tasks that we have. We are not called to like people, rather we are called to love them, and that's a much higher standard, and we are struggling with that again now in the streets in response to police matters and so on, and what we're really looking at is how do we identify unjust social systems, and what is it that from our faith traditions we can bring to this conversation that will be constructive and not destructive?
What can we bring from our faith traditions that will be constructive, Bill? Do you have ideas around that?
Well, I do. One of them is to be engaged in interfaith dialogue so that we understand that the major world religions have a lot in common in terms of how they teach people to live in loving and generative ways. In fact, at the end of my new book that's not yet out, I have a chapter in which I outline 8 or 10 steps that people can take to try to eliminate or reduce religious extremism, which is what led to 9/11 and to a number of other terrorism attacks. And one of the first things, of course, is to go to your own faith tradition and learn it well so that you're able to draw from it and defend it. And second is to learn from others. Do what Barbara Brown Taylor in her most recent book called Holy Envy does, which is to figure out what it is about other faith traditions that you like enough to want to borrow, whether it's the Muslims' tradition of daily 5 times a day prayer or the Jewish tradition of forgiveness and reconciliation and memory. Or whatever it is, there are lots of things we can learn from other faith traditions, and we can begin to integrate those into our lives and thus become part of the answer in this time where we are all struggling with how we move forward in a fair way.
Yeah, and I think some of it is... I don't know whose line it was. Maybe it was Henry Kissinger, the old line, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. I mean, if you're a white male, like you and I are in this society, you've always been kind of one up in a way, and you've always had an advantage on many fronts over people of color. Now, you know, when you have the power, those with power typically don't readily give it up. I was just talking to Ron Rollheiser, a Catholic priest, about the all-male priesthood. And then to me, there are some similarities. There's no scriptural basis for that, you know, I mean, all the other denominations have women at leadership levels. In fact, if I have 2 daughters, they can basically do anything in this country other than be a Roman Catholic priest, you know? Well, why is that? Why is the Roman Catholic Church so slow to change? Oh, I think they've got the power. When you have the power, you tend not to give it up easily, whether it's wrapped in religious terms or not. You know, the Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement was now, and there were plenty of religious white people saying, yeah, but can we slow down? And anyway, I see some similarities there.
Yeah, and the reality is that you and I we won the ovarian lottery. I was born in the middle of the 20th century in the United States to white parents. I mean, it doesn't much more privilege than that. And, you know, my family was never a well-to-do family. We were middle class at best. But none of that mattered if you were white, and I ended up as a tall guy as well, tall white guy in the 20th century and now the 21st century. the benefits that came from that, I earned none of them. And that's what we've got to recognize and see what we can do to give those benefits to everyone.
Well, and just the education alone is a challenge because, everyone's at a different level of kind of comprehending some of these systemic issues on race and in other areas. So I want to ask you, so the time didn't get away from us, about the just wonderful work your church has done, and you're going to need to give me a refresher course with attracting the under 30 crowd. And there's this little, many of the Kansas Cityans know about the Open Table, but it's one of the local byproducts of that work. But can you unpackage that for us, what your church did and how much money and time you committed to make that work?
Yeah, the Open Table began as an alternative worshiping community almost 5 years ago. We brought in a guy, Nick Pickrell, whose background includes work in Catholic worker houses.
Right.
And what we said to Nick was, think about how to reach out to the unchurched. Think about how to draw in people who are not interested in sitting in pews, staring to the front of the church, listening to a lecture on Sunday mornings. See what alternatives there are out there and see if it works. So eventually the Open Table adopted the model of what's now called a dinner church. They gather two Sundays a month in the evening. They have dinner together around a common table. That is, in effect, their communion. And then they gather for music, conversation, worship, sometimes in the same room, sometimes in another room. They are housed at Second Pres. But they have also begun to work in the anti-racism area. Their members get trained in this area, and then they go out and get hired by businesses to come in and do diversity training, anti-racism training. And it's really been rather a remarkable story. It started out with maybe 15 or 20 people on average on a Sunday night, and now it's closer to 100, and they've had at times 175, 200 people at one time. And all kinds of people come who generally have not been active in a congregation and didn't see much reason to be. But the Open Table has spoken to them, and it's really done remarkable work.
Yeah, and having been at a handful of those events on the diversity scale, I mean, you can sit down at a table, and you may sit next to a college professor with multiple degrees. On your left, on your right, there may be a homeless person that took a bus in from the inner city. So it's an amazing collection of folks, and yeah, they do a great job with it. But that's the local one. But wasn't this also part of a national campaign by the Presbyterian Church to kind of address the under 30 crowd that just wasn't going to institutional churches anymore? Or am I not remembering that correctly?
Oh, that's correct. In fact, that is called 1001 New Worshiping Communities. The program of the Presbyterian Church USA. I don't know what number they are up to now toward the 1001, but the Open Table has become in many ways kind of the model for the rest of the denomination on how to do this. So we're feeling really good about that.
Mm. Tell me about theology. You made a point early on, Bill, that that's been a passion of yours, reading theology. You're a reader, a writer, a speaker. Who are the folks out there, living or dead, who have been most influential on you in your journey?
Oh, my. Well, if just in terms of basic theology, a kind of systematic theology, a couple of people immediately come to mind. One is Shirley Guthrie. That's a male. the late Shirley Guthrie, whose book is called Christian Doctrine. That's flat title. And it really gives a wonderful, easily understood summary of Reformed tradition theology. Reformed tradition essentially meaning Presbyterian. Daniel Migliori, who until recently taught at Princeton Theological Seminary, has a book called Faith Seeking Understanding that does some of what Shirley Guthrie does. Robert Jensen is a Lutheran clergy person, just recently deceased, but his book on systematic theology has been very helpful to me. There are some people like Frederick Buechner and Annie Dillard, whose books are not systematic theology, but they are marinated in theology, and it comes through in many ways. Same with my friend Kathleen Norris, starting with her book Dakota, A Spiritual Geography. So those are some of the people who have been important to me, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a bunch, Harvey Cox, among others, but those are some that have written things that have stuck with me.
I love that. I think is it Buechner? Is that how he says his name?
Buechner.
That one quote. I only know one quote from him, but I love it. It was one of the two quotes we looked at every year when I went to this two-year program at Richard Rohr's place. But something about where your happiness and the world's needs meet, that is where you are called to serve. Am I in the ballpark there? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
Does that work for you? If I were to paraphrase that or repeat that correctly and ask you that, what would you say, Bill?
Well, I agree with Buechner about that. And, my passion in life has been writing, but not just writing for writing. Rather, my job, as I've seen it, is to try to draw meaning out of what's happening in the world in front of me and process that and turn around and give that meaning back to my readers in a way that will make some sense for them. And thus, the title of my very first book was called A Gift of Meaning. It was a collection of star columns. So, I see people struggling to understand the complexities of life and to get through the mysteries and the ambiguities and the paradoxes. And my job, it seems to me, is to help them with that and in the process help myself struggle with those same mysteries.
Oh, good. Speaking of a mystery, let me give you an easy mystery to solve. Current politics. So we have this current circumstance here where I think, at least in my lifetime, never have the two parties been so divided. Never has dialogue been so poor. How did we get here? And is there an easy way out? Do you have any thoughts on that?
There are lots of theories about how we got here. Some people blame Newt Gingrich, and I think there's something to that. Newt really wanted power, and he wanted a fairly narrow political agenda. And when you combine that with the entertainers who imagined themselves to be political commentators, like Rush Limbaugh. You get a divisiveness in our culture that is really hard to solve. And one of the ways that, and maybe the only way we can get past this is to relearn to listen to each other and to relearn that the other person is not a Satan, not a demon, but rather is also a human being. And that's where our faith traditions come in. That's what we have to learn from our faith traditions. And we have a president without any such tradition, even though he once claimed he was a Presbyterian. But you know, nearly everything he does and says is in some way a violation of foundational religious principles. And until we can kind of get past that, I don't know what we do. But we certainly can't give up on the American experiment. It's important that it continue and that it find a way out of this wilderness right now.
Yes.
That kind of extremist thinking is also something that I'm tackling in my next book.
Is there an easy explanation in your mind for the notion that this president, as divisive as he seems to be, with no real faith tradition as he seems to have, still has astronomical support among certain Christian portions? I think the evangelical community is 80% pro-Trump. How can that be? That just is very difficult to square up on its face.
I know. There have been a lot of theories about why that was the case in the 2016 vote. And some people say it's because they wanted judges on the Supreme Court, justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. It's a whole abortion thing. The reality is that Christian evangelicals who identify that way simply got sucked into power, and they have abandoned their moral center in many ways. They have set themselves up to damage not just evangelical Christianity, but religion in general. And I'm just really glad that there are some evangelical Christians who are standing up against this now. There's a new book out edited by Ron Sider, a really smart evangelical Christian, called The Spiritual Danger of Donald Trump. And I'll have a review of that book in the National Catholic Reporter in the next week or so. But he's gathered 30 or so evangelical Christians to warn other evangelical Christians not to make the same mistake they made in 2016 and vote for Trump.
Probably anxious to see that. I just re-upped my subscription to the National Catholic Reporter. You were talking about faith traditions in a moment ago, and I want to take you to a little different subject, the inner life. If you're comfortable, do you have what spiritual practices are important to you? How do you craft your inner life, so to speak?
I tend to do it in community. That is, for instance, I have been part of a small group of men from my church. We have met once a week. We meet on Wednesday mornings now. We've met since 1982, I think.
Oh my!
We meet for breakfast. We share what's going on in our lives, and then we read scripture together, and then we do a round robin prayer together. I help to lead a downtown Bible study group that meets at when there's no pandemic, that meets at San Francisco Tower at Crown Center. It has met in different places around downtown, but we've been at that location for at least a dozen years. That group also started back in the 80s, and it's been a very important group to me. It used to be clergy-led, but some clergy came and went, and I ended up kind of as the unelected leader. But it's important to me because it means there's good conversation about scripture and about how we apply it to our lives. I am, of course, a member of a church, Second Pres, and I'm regular part of a Sunday school class, adult Sunday school class that now meets by Zoom, and that has become a small community for me. In addition, My wife and I do things together that I think of as spiritually uplifting, and we always end our day with a short prayer that is part of the Episcopal Compline service. Compline that ends end of day service, and so I am not a contemplative. That is, I am not one who can go sit and meditate alone for hour after hour and do that. I admire people who have that ability. I don't. And so I recognize that about myself and try in other ways to have a life of faith that is both vibrant and sustaining.
Yeah, well, but to me, there's got to be a contemplative dimension just in what you do, in the reading, in the writing. I mean, that's a very contemplative undertaking. Do you just sit down at a typewriter and it magically appears, or yeah, I assume you have to go through lots of quiet thinking and journaling and so forth before you get the sense of what you want to write and how you want to tackle certain issues, or how does it work for you? Maybe it's
well,
a better way.
In some ways, I often don't know what I think about something until I begin to write about it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it is in the kind of organic unpacking of the words as they flow that I say, oh, I see where this is going. Oh, that no, I don't want to go there because that doesn't make any sense. And so it's a kind of organic writing that that helps me think and contemplate my way through an issue.
Yeah. So you're an extrovert as a writer.
Yeah, it's a little backwards, but it works for me.
I got a couple quirky questions for you. Question one, you are president right now, Bill. What are, and you don't care about being reelected or anything, but you're just president, and what are the top one, two, three issues that in your mind we need to address now? What are the most important issues of our day?
Wow. Well, underlying all of these issues is that I will mention is the idea that we have to create that all of our systems have to be racially just, and so we need to work on ways to undo the racism that's in our system. Having said that, I still believe that ecological degradation should be high on the list. This is our only planet, and we have made a mess of it, and we've got to quickly do what we can to fix that. Education has to be high on the list. It used to be that high school education was all a lot of people needed, and it was free. That minimum needs to be extended through junior college, and we've got to find ways to make higher education more available to everyone on a fair basis. Our whole criminal justice system needs a restructure from policing to incarceration to any aspect of justice. We've also got to look at how we deal with children in this country, and the ways that we in some ways traumatize them through poverty, through schools that don't work, through foster care systems that ruin lives and save some lives, but there are all of those, in addition to creating a global partnership with other nations instead of competing militarily with them in so many ways. So if we can solve that in the week of the next presidency, I'll be really happy.
I'm ready to vote for you. I think you need to run, and that lovely wife of yours needs to be the campaign manager, and that's That's a formidable team right there.
You're kind, but I'm not running for anything.
You're not? Dang it. And you got a big extended family. You got kids and grandkids, yes?
I do. Between us, my wife and I have six children, grown children, and eight grandchildren. All eight grandchildren are here in the area. They range from 18 to 4. And all of our kids, except for one, live in this area. So our extended family is 18 or 20 folks, and we try to get together with some frequency. But
That's fun.
Yeah, it's also that's been fun. Hard in this COVID time. But
oh, yes. But how nice that you've got eight here in KC, 4 through 18, and that just tells me that you'll be a great grandpa sometime probably in the next 5-10 years, which has got to be very exciting because you and your wife are young and healthy.
Well, there are no promises, as you know, but we look forward to what's coming for sure.
That's great. Okay, tell us about, as much as you want to tell us about your upcoming book, and I think what we're going to do is kind of time the release of this interview to a point nearer in time to the release of the book, but okay. Are you inclined to maybe tell us a little more of what people can look for?
Sure. The book should be out in January, maybe February, but it's called Love, Loss, and Endurance, and the subtitle is a 9/11 story of resilience and hope in an age of anxiety. And what I do in this book is to tell the story of the murder of my nephew, my sister's son, Carlton, who was on the first plane to hit the World Trade Center on 9/11, and what that did to shake up and traumatize our family, and how we have tried to recover from that just as an extended family. But I don't stop that. I also try to explore the question of how people, some people get sucked into monochromatic, straitjacketed religious thinking that can lead to violence. I look at a number of sources to help figure that out, and then at the end of the book, I have a series of ideas and suggestions for people who want to try to be part of the solution to stop the kind of extremism that murdered Carlton and that shot up Mindy Corcoran's father and son and Jim Lomano's wife here in 2014 by a neo-Nazi, and the synagogue shootings in Pittsburgh and Poway, and the Mother Emanuel shootings in Charleston, and those kinds of things. I try to take a look at to see what we can do to make sure that we minimize those things and we hope eliminate them. So that's the thrust of the book. It does get into our personal family story to quite an extent, but not simply to reveal family secrets, but rather for the larger purpose of looking at how we deal with this whole issue of extremism.
Yes, that's wonderful, and hopefully you'll be out and about speaking some with the release of that book.
Well, I hope so, and I'm waiting for a time when we can actually gather several hundred people in one room and talk. But however
we can do webinars. That's what we're doing right now, and these seem to be working pretty well for folks during this COVID stretch.
Yeah, that and Zoom and all kinds of ways. But I, for many reasons, much prefer to speak to a group in person about books I write and to have open engagement and conversation about it rather than hide electronically.
Yeah, I understand. What's the seems like a particularly germane question for a guy like you? with all the kids and the grandkids and all your work over the years, theology, spirituality, and so forth. What's the future of the church? What are things going to look like in 10, 20 years? How will the institutional mainline denominations fare? And are we going to see the under 30 crowd end up somewhere, maybe in these new dinner churches? Any thoughts on that?
I think we have not seen the end of the reduction in membership in particularly mainline Protestant churches. A number of those churches, including mine, have tried to find ways to stem that tide and to be out in the community doing what we need to be doing. But we're not through with that yet. So will things like the dinner church take the place of a traditional church? Some will. But I think we are also perhaps looking at some possibilities of other kinds of community gatherings that have a spiritual touch to them but aren't necessarily led by traditional churches. I think, for instance, if you look at who was, what religious groups were driving the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, it was in many ways the Black church. Mm-hmm. Today, the Black Lives Matters movement has Black church support and white church support, but its leadership doesn't directly come from the church. And so we may find that pattern extended in other areas as well. Will weekly worship on Sunday mornings continue? Of course it will, but it's going to be different. And you know what that will look like is anyone's guess. I've almost abandoned trying to predict that, because every time you make that kind of prediction in a year, you are proven wrong.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I think is a fairly undeniable trend, at least in Roman Catholicism, it's not top-down anymore. It's bottom-up. You know, people aren't sitting around much waiting for the clergy to tell them what to do. You know, in my tradition, Vatican II, was a major step in that direction, but there more and more laity involvement, more laity leadership. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's been an important part of the Protestant life almost since the beginning. And what I notice now is that our ordained pastors, we have a senior pastor and an associate pastor, and about a third of the time, they are not in the pulpit. Some member of our congregation is either in dialogue with them as a sermon, or is giving the sermon himself or herself, or there's someone else from the outside that comes in. So there's a lot of drawing on the strengths of the body beyond the pastors, and we've tried to kind of demythologize the pastors so that we don't have the problem that has frankly plagued the Catholic Church of clericalism.
Yeah, a huge problem.
Yeah, it remains a problem, and I think this Pope understands that, although I don't know that he's done enough to combat it, but that is less and less of a problem in many mainline Protestant churches. We've democratized our leadership, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that was maybe one of the issues you and I visited about years ago. You know, the other thing I see is, you know, in the old days, I mean, if you were in my tradition and you felt the tug of God, you went to the seminary. I mean, that's just kind of what you did. That was considered the way or the better way. Now there are these programs sprouting up everywhere that are kind of alternatives to someone who wants to learn more. You have to go to the seminary. You know, you can go to the spiritual academy or the living school, Richard Rohr, Ron Rollheiser's Forest Dwelling School, or, you know, and there are many others out there. But that trend, I think, is out there and hopefully will continue. And it just, I think, gives spiritual seekers other options other than the traditional seminary, ordained, so forth.
Yeah, not only that, but the people who are going to seminary, many of them are not going into parish ministry. They're going into industrial chaplaincy. They're going into hospice chaplaincy. They're going into nonprofit organizations. So they're using their theology degree to do ministry in different ways.
Yeah, so that's encouraging. I didn't know that. Okay, last question. We're going to hypothetically kill you, and you've got 1 hour to live. So let's just say that you wanted to leave the listeners with kind of your thoughts. You've been on this planet for a while. I'm thinking you're mid-70s now, plus or minus, about right?
Yep.
What do you think? What are the rules for the road? What are, if you had to distill down the most important aspects of what you've learned over the years to a couple sentence or a couple paragraphs, what would you want people to know?
Well, it's really hard to go wrong by saying, read 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the love chapter. That's what we're called to do to one another, to be there for one another. We are called to be God's hands and feet for one another. We fail at that every day. I fail at that every day, but that doesn't mean that we can give up on that. We have to care about one another and encourage one another and grieve with one another and celebrate with one another, and not simply find where we disagree and beat each other up about that. Let's celebrate our diverse thinking and our diverse being as the way that God created us. So, love is kind and generous, and that's what we need to be. And love is not puffed up, as Paul wrote, and that's what we also don't need to be, is puffed up about who we are, but to have some sense of modesty about ourselves.
Mm. Outstanding. All right. Well, stay healthy, Bill Timaeus. We need more Bill Timaeuses in this world.
I think one is more than enough, Mike, but you're kind to say that.
Thank you, my friend. This has been a pleasure visiting with you, and until we meet again, and thank you for the time.
Thank you. I'm really glad that we had the chance to do this, and I hope it's helpful to somebody. So take care, Mike.